It's one of the scare tactics we see the most from people who have sought to use transphobic rhetoric to achieve a change in school policy or healthcare outcomes, or just to achieve political power. The person who transitioned from one gender to another then came to regret that decision and is now speaking out about it to warn the world about the dangers of gender-affirming care. But how common is it for someone to detransition? Does detransitioning actually mean that the person was wrong in their thinking about their gender in the first place? My name is Eric Bowman. I'm the communications person at the CPA, and this is Mindful. I think we all must be aware on some level that the number of times we see people on TV or read about them online who have detransitioned and regret it is not reflective of the actual number of people who do. Right? These are all anecdotes that get shared many thousands of times more than the stories of people who never detransitioned, or people who detransitioned but don't regret their journey or the process, or maybe people who detransitioned and then retransitioned. So let's learn something today. Once again, I'm happy to welcome back Jesse and Francoise, our experts from last week's episode on cisnormativity in healthcare. This week, we're going to get into detransitioning, and this has become such a buzzword for people who want to enact anti-trans legislation. The anecdotal experiences of a few people who have detransitioned suggests to them that we're doing this too quickly, that all of a sudden people come into a doctor's office and get prescribed medication immediately and then have a surgery 6 weeks later and then regret it. And at the end of last week's episode, we were talking about New Brunswick. And I kind of wanted to go back there and start there. The premier of New Brunswick, in enacting some of this legislation, justified it by sort of picking out a slide from a presentation about the experiences of youth, adolescents going through transitioning services and experiencing the healthcare system in that way, and quoted one slide that said 60% of youth immediately get prescribed hormones upon going into a doctor's office. Now, of course, and I said last week that I found it somewhat encouraging that he had to reach out to an American healthcare professional who was willing to take the consultant's fee and come and back up this assertion that he made, and that the author of the study then had to come out and say, no, this isn't in fact what this said at all, that they've seen, you know, 2.7, I think, healthcare professionals on average before they even get to the point where that consultation will lead to them getting something prescribed for them. We talked a little bit about that, but I do think that it's in a way missing the larger question, which to me is, let's say that that even was true, that a youth goes in to see a doctor, see a counselor, see a psychologist, and comes out of there with a prescription for gender altering hormones, for estrogen or testosterone, and I must admit, I don't know exactly how all of these medications work, but The real question, I think, might be, is that a bad thing? Would that be a bad thing if that were the case? And, you know, is there such a thing as doing this too quickly? Or, you know, because the theory being we do it too quickly, then somebody's going to regret their decision because they went in on the spur of the moment to talk to a physician and then later regretted that decision. What is the likelihood of that happening? And is there such a thing as too quickly? Francoise, let's start with you.
I would love to live in a world where somebody can have a spur of the moment appointment with a doctor anywhere in Canada. That would be lovely. I think, and the first thing that I'm going to say, and this is a common mistake, so it's. I'm glad that you brought it up this way, because then we can adjust things, is that a lot of the moral panic is around not even hormones, not even what will influence the development of the body or change the body. It's about puberty blockers. So we're not even talking about making any change. We're just talking about puberty delaying medication. Medication that is used and has been used for the last 20 some years in kids, and I'm going to say kids, and children who have precocious puberty. So sometimes the gland in the that is responsible for triggering adolescence will, for some reason, start the development of the secondary sex characteristics in a six-year-old. Well, we know we don't want a six-year-old to be developing as an adolescent would. So pediatricians know this medication, these medications very well, and we'll just administer that medication and the child will stay on it until puberty, and then we'll remove it and the puberty will go on. So there's nothing new about these medications. They're very well proven to work well, and we've prescribed them for cisgender kids much younger than what we're talking about doing here. Here we're talking about delaying for a while puberty so that the youth, the adolescent, can journey and can figure out what it is that they want when that's the case, or we're delaying it because there's actually medical reasons why you want the body to develop a certain way before you start administering the hormones that will actually make the body develop in the direction that corresponds to the youth's gender identity. So all of that hullabaloo is often around a medication that just delays puberty a little bit, and not even about cross-sex hormones. So that's important to bring in also. And the concern then is that the youth that are on these medications will then have access to cross-sex hormones. Well, yes, because these are the youth that actually need to have their body develop in the direction of their gender identity. So of course, there's a great deal of them that will go on, but not all of them. And some of them will say, you know, I tried the blockers and my body's not developing into, you know, this into the adolescent body that my cohort is having, you know, happen to their body. And I'm realizing that, no, it's not really for me, which is great, which is the whole point of this in many cases, not all, but in many cases, the point is to give the chance for the youth to see what it is that works for them. But there's actually medical reasons why we don't put the 12 or 13 year old at a certain stage of puberty directly on cross-sex hormones. And that has a lot to do with the bone development, et cetera. So there's medical reasons why we start with the blockers when these are youth around, you know, what we call Tanner stage 2 or 3 of puberty.
So how does that work exactly? You're a 13 year old boy comes to the doctor and says, you know, I'm actually a girl. The doctor will then prescribe puberty blockers so that that child doesn't go through the puberty that other male children at that time go through with the, and I'm not clear on this exactly, but then later on, you're able to prescribe hormones for that child so that they can transition to female, and then you allow puberty to progress and it will be a female puberty. Is that essentially the nuts and bolts of how that works?
I think that's, like, in a nutshell, that's what it looks like. So understanding that the purpose of the blockers is to give time, is to pause in a way. And what I will say is, in those messages that we see in the media, the panic around, you know, we see these words being used all the time, irreversible changes, right? Permanent changes. And there's a lot of focus on the irreversible or the permanent change that taking what they refer to as cross-sex hormones will do to a body. So for example, someone who's assigned female at birth goes on puberty blockers and then will take testosterone. We talk about the irreversible changes of taking testosterone. That's a cisnormative bias, because we do not talk about the irreversible changes of the endogenous estrogen in that person's body, right? So that person who's assigned female at birth, who identifies, let's say, non-binary or as a man, if there is no puberty blocker given, that person's body will feminize. That person's body will change in a way that doesn't align with their gender identity. And some of those things are irreversible. We don't talk about that.
Right.
Right. But that's, you know, so that's a cisnormative bias right there, that we only see some changes as bad and irreversible and damaging if it doesn't conform to a cisnormative idea of gender.
That makes sense. I hadn't thought of it in that way before. That makes perfect sense. The way I had thought about it before was that really the only irreversible change is surgery, that's the only thing that, you know, and presumably even then there's some sort of way to reverse that if you wanted to. If you can do it one way, I presume you could do it the other way as well. And that's kind of what I wanted to talk about here, is this idea of regretting a transition and detransitioning. And Françoise, you wrote about this in our latest issue of Synopsis, where you gave a specific example of a young person that you counseled who ended up regretting transitioning later on. And I'm hoping you can sort of walk us through that, this idea that, you know, how much of this is actually irreversible and how much of it is, in fact, something that you can change at a later date. You also said that people who detransition often retransition later on as well.
Yeah. So I think part of the challenge here for clinicians is to adopt a paradigm that allows for evolution, development, allows for doubt, allows for questions, allows for this was right at a certain time of my life and it's not necessarily how I feel today, right? So I think part of what's happened, and I talked about this at the York, there was a York symposium on detransition, and I was invited to do the keynote, and I was saying that part of the problem is we don't welcome doubt into our office. We don't welcome questioning into our office because clinicians are so afraid themselves. This is a big part of counter transference here around trans issues. So there's a lot of fear. It's like, oh, it is my responsibility to make this decision for this person, whether they should go ahead or not. And so what we work really hard at, and Jesse and I work on this regularly, is to have clinicians understand that just like any other major decision, and I wrote that in the article, that our clients may make in their life, it's not up to us to make those decisions, but it is up to us to clear the space for them to be able to reflect on what it is that they want to do. So I would say that that's the first thing, is to adopt a perspective on gender identity that is not some kind of very fixed idea in time that never will move. For many people, it won't. For many people, and I can't give you the numbers, but for many people, the transition, whether it's to a non-binary identity or to a binary trans identity, will be, you know, pretty much what they will experience their whole life. And great. And for some people, it'll move. So when we say that there's some, it's kind of informal data. This has not yet been demonstrated per se, that up to 60% of people who will come back to a cis identity will then move back to a non-binary identity. What we're talking about is that fluidity and that search for self. And a lot of times we also don't talk about how it's a journey. It's a gender journey. And for some people, it will be a journey that for some reason, for many reasons, bring people back to identifying as cis, or without identifying as cisgender. Let's say going from a trans masculine or trans feminine identity to non-binary, or just staying trans masculine, but saying, you know what, I kind of miss this about my body. Right? I kind of want this. So there's two things. There's identity, and then there's what people will want in terms of embodiment needs. And those are two spheres that need to be considered separately. Just because somebody says they're non-binary doesn't mean that they don't want hormone surgery and the whole thing. And same thing, somebody could say they're trans and they identify as man or woman and not want certain things. So that's a common mistake, is to think that because we have somebody's identity at the moment that we know what they want medically. And that's, those two things don't always correspond. And they don't always correspond over time as well. So sometimes people will shift back to a cis identity, but will have zero regret about their chest surgery. If we're talking about somebody assigned female at birth, for example, who had chest surgery and maybe some testosterone that will lower the voice pitch. And they're like, oh yeah, but that's much more comfortable for me. As a woman, I really am glad that I don't have that anymore. My chest is flat and that my voice is a little bit lower. It's not this high pitch voice that I had before testosterone. So we have to be very, I'll say to clinicians, first, you need to breathe. When somebody comes to your office and I regret my transition, or I don't regret my transition, but I want to change certain things back. The first thing is for us to calm down and then to go, okay, well, tell me where you're at in your gender journey. And so there are many reasons also. So studies have been informing us for several years now that a lot of people will come back to a cisgender life because of social pressure, because of rejection from family, because of rejection from employers, because of the kind of harassment or abuse that they experience. So there's a lot of social factors that will interrupt somebody's gender journey and will make them say, look, my life will be simpler if I just live my life this way and, you know, just buy peace. And that's worrisome too, because if I have somebody in my office who's wanting to detransition, and by the way, I use the word detransition, it is a controversial word in the detrans community. So there is such a thing as a detrans community, just like the trans community and gender diverse community. It's an umbrella term that captures a whole lot of different realities. And there's a lot of different points of view and different positionings within the detrans community. So just because somebody goes back to a cis identity or a cis life, A, it doesn't mean that they regret, and B, it doesn't mean that it's forever either. So sometimes, as I was saying, as a clinician, I could be just as concerned, like, because some people will detransition for those reasons, and then the gender dysphoria will come back in a powerful way and will be very destabilizing. And then I'm very concerned about what they're going to do. Because if they feel trapped, if they feel that they can't express their gender as they experience it, which is not a cis identity or gender, if they feel like that's not possible because the losses are too great, but being cis and perceived as cis is absolutely unbearable, then we start to worry, right? And when our clients are in a cul-de-sac, we worry, because then the suicide can seem like an exit, a possible exit. So these are crises we want to avoid. It's important also to find out what's going on, what's motivating the decision to change certain things about the body or to go back to an identity, a cis identity.
You mentioned the societal pressures, and I'm thinking about, for a long time, I've worked with youth who have substance use issues. I find that a lot of the time, people who have overcome substance use issues, many of the more vocal ones, tend to be against harm reduction measures. The idea being, I've come through this, I've reached a point where I didn't need drugs anymore. You can do it the same way I did. All this other stuff is just enabling, you know, and there's a sort of hostility toward people who are still struggling with that. And I think that in this circumstance, the people who have detransitioned that I see in the media are the most vocal, but they tend to also be the most vocal saying, none of this should happen because it happened to me this way and I detransitioned. And, you know, I think that a lot of that is the societal pressure, the cis normity of the healthcare system, as you said, where once they realize, okay, I've done this and I didn't want to, I'm going to detransition, then they feel like, oh, people told me this all along. Oh, you know, this is what the healthcare system was trying to tell me. Why didn't I listen? And now I'm going to be evangelical about preventing, similar care to be provided to other people. And they're so anecdotal, but they tend to be the vocal ones who get elevated by the people who, you know, want to press this specific agenda. We don't hear a lot of voices about people who have detransitioned but are still happy with the journey that they took and that sort of thing. And so I'm wondering how much of this detransition notion comes from societal pressure and how much just comes from a natural part of the journey? And can you even separate the two, given the cis normativity of the healthcare system and the certain misunderstanding that could happen through every step of that process? Jesse, if you have any thoughts on that, I'd love to hear them.
I think that as clinicians, we're finding ourselves having to navigate, you know, balancing different needs. And what I mean by that is this example that you're giving, let's say the people that are most vocal, that are, you know, maybe have gotten radicalized also in their ideology, and they're really pushing forward an agenda of like banning transition for everyone, you know. I think that there's a way for us to not invalidate that person's lived experience, but also not use it to formulate best practices. And this is kind of the edge that we're navigating here. We would never just take one experience, one anecdotal experience, and then develop policies and best practices around that. We don't do that in any area of health. We shouldn't do it in trans health either. And so I think this is why we want to really be nuanced in how we navigate this. In the same way that there's a million different ways of transitioning, there's a million different ways of detransitioning. It's very individual. It's very, you know, it needs to be tailored to the needs of the one individual. So as soon as you have someone coming out in the media saying, banning, you know, like taking very drastic measure for everyone, blanket statement, no transition for anyone under the age of XYZ, that's not in line with the best practices. That's going to actually cause a lot of harm, right? So in a way, we want to navigate between allowing space for people to reflect, allowing space for that informed consent process to happen, but also not overextending into an area where, as a healthcare provider, we're intentionally or maybe even unintentionally delaying the process in order to prevent regret, because we know that doesn't work. The research has showed us time and time and again that there is no way of preventing regret. There is no way of preventing detransition, right? More gatekeeping practices. So making it, quote, harder for people to access transition is not related to less detransition, is not related to less regret. There's no link between those two things. And so I think that's the reflex. People tend to go, oh, let's prevent detransition, then let's make transition harder for everyone. Well, guess what? You're going to lose a lot of people to suicide in that way. That's not better either. So we really have to navigate. It's a balancing act between those two tensions.
And you mentioned the healthcare system doesn't rely on anecdotal evidence, that they, you know, go by data, and that there, it strikes me that there's a lot more room for nuance in the healthcare system than there is in the political system. And the political system relies heavily on anecdotes, right? People respond more to anecdotes than they do to data. People don't understand data for the most part. I don't understand a lot of data, but I can feel a visceral reaction to an anecdote that I hear. The healthcare system can do all of the right things and still be derailed by the political system. And I'm just wondering if, I mean, can we find anecdotes to counteract the larger narrative that's so loud right now?
That's a good question. I think you're talking here about, like, how do we combat misinformation and disinformation?
Right.
Because this is what we're dealing with, right? Like, there is widespread right now anti-trans misinformation and disinformation. So misinformation is false information, but disinformation is deliberately propagating false and misleading information. So this is what we're dealing with right now. And what we know is that, you know, myth busting and debunking can do some work on that front, but it's a little limited in terms of, like, combating the spread of misinformation. And so one of the things that we're seeing right now as a technique that's, you know, some of the psych research is showing us could be more beneficial than debunking is what we call pre-bunking. And in pre-bunking, the idea is, can we teach people to develop sort of like a critical judgment about the information, think more critically, and kind of see the misleading tactics and the fallacies in the arguments being provided. So a lot of what we're talking here is, you know, relying on fear and outrage, like sparking fear, sparking outrage, and misrepresenting proportionality. I think most of the anti-trans misinformation we see out there is false somewhere within those three things. So I think if we have clinicians that are aware of those fallacies and those misleading tactics, then you can be better equipped to not fall prey to that information and to not let that information seep through your belief system and implicitly impact how you work with clients. Because that's the real problem, I think, here, is you hear those things, it has an impact on you emotionally, and then you may be even unaware that that's going to impact how you work with trans people on an implicit level.
And I think that there's that's something that we lose sight of a lot, too, is that nobody is immune to disinformation, misinformation, right? You get overwhelmed with this, you hear it all the time, and after a while, it does sort of inform even the most educated doctors and clinicians and psychologists who hear all of this stuff and then don't really know what to believe. And a lot of the time err on the side of doing nothing. And, you know, that there's that nobody can hide from this forever kind of thing, right?
You know, you talk about it'd be great to have positive anecdotes. We have hundreds and thousands of positive anecdotes, but it's not very sexy. So, you know, it's not going to catch the media's eye to say, well, you know, so, you know, Mrs. Tremblay started her transition at age 26, and then was just living her life. Like, they don't know, they're not interested in those stories. They're interested in the sensational stories. And then, unfortunately, I have colleagues who will quote newspaper articles. And this is really problematic because as a field, we are not supposed to be relying on newspaper articles. Even the more sophisticated newspapers like the New York Times have been criticized heavily in the last couple of years for putting out articles that really were problematic and did not reflect the current state of information on the topic. So I would say, you know, we don't do this for anything else in our field. We need to be very careful not to rely on what we're reading out there. This is why I talked about education, education, education last week. It's really important. Now, we do have a fairly solid set of guidelines that are published by the World Professional Association for Transgender Health. They have come out with their most recent guidelines in 2022, Standards of Care 8, version 8, which is the result of a worldwide consultation with hundreds of clinicians, researchers, et cetera, people from the community as well who are working in research, et cetera. And this is a 350-page document that are the official guidelines. Now, it's telling that the psychologists, for example, it was found by the premier in New Brunswick, no longer adheres to, is no longer part of WPATH, has distanced herself from WPATH. And when she does quote something, she quotes the Standards of Care 7, which were published in 2011, which is a long, long, long time ago in any research field, but a long time in terms of trans health research, where we have, you know, 100% more data that was collected in the last 10 years or 12 years than we had in 2011. So I guess what I want to say is I want to urge colleagues to not fall prey to what is being talked about right now, because it is not correct. And we could, you know, we do have an obligation as psychologists to work from, you know, from the data that is most up to date and that is most accurate. Now, we understand that in human science research, there's no absolutes, but there is a collection of data that does guide our work and does guide our practice. And I would say it's very easy to download or to go consult the Standards of Care 8 on the WPATH website. And it's a great starting point. I would say, you know, anybody who's interested in trans health, if you want to cut through the noise, start by this document. If you only work with adolescents, go to the adolescent chapter. Start there. You know, play around with it, download it. It's going to be, I think, orderable at some point in paper version, but it's the standards of care. And many fields have these standards of care, these guidelines. They're not absolutes, but they are the best we have in terms of collected information and research. And it went through a very, very rigorous process in order to get these guidelines, to produce these guidelines. So, you know, that will cut through the noise and will help you as a clinician to see through all that. Besides that, I would say, please just try to have a critical perspective, or at least to not by what you're hearing in the media. It's the problem is that we spend a lot of time, and Jesse and I both, and many other colleagues, educating journalists. But it's complex. It's nuanced, as Jesse was saying. There are many nuances. So oftentimes journalists, they miss the nuances, and they don't have, they have 900 or 1,000 words that they have to produce. They're not going to go into the nuances. And so what they produce ends up being false, or being false enough to create a problem in terms of where society positions themselves.
As I'm listening to this, something that seems pretty central to me in terms of like dismantling that cisnormativity and an invitation to peers and colleagues working in trans health is starting to really reflect on the origin of that like detrans panic, like sitting with that a little bit, like what's going on there that you are, we're panicking around people detransitioning. We talked earlier about how we need to normalize doubt and regret and uncertainty. And I really want to point out something here is that as psychologists and healthcare providers, we deal with doubt and regret and uncertainty all the time, but we don't freak out about it. We don't take it to the media, right? It's part of life. It's normal. So I think I'm trying to point out here that there's a cisnormative flavor to that aversion here in the doubt. And, we could have people that will alter their gender in a way that conforms with gender cisnormativity. So you can have a cisgender woman who's going to decide to go for breast augmentation and then later regret. Do we talk about that in the media? Do we prevent all cisgender women from getting breast augmentation? We don't, right? So there's a flavor of cisnormativity and detransphobia to the doubt that is not the same. And I think that as clinicians, we need to sit with that. We need to recognize that there's something here that that isn't really part of the conversation, but there's something that's going on there. Why is it that this doubt really has me freaking out? That uncertainty I can't sit with as a clinician versus other certainty in other clinical presentations, I'm okay with that. So again, it comes back to this cisnormativity.
That's interesting because I think that sitting with doubt is a big part of this. And, exploring this journey, the transition journey, detransition, whatever it may be. Francoise, in your article, I seem to remember you saying that for a lot of people who are undertaking this process, who are going to see somebody who say, I do want puberty blockers, I do want hormone therapies, I do want a surgery, there's a pressure on them to be adamant about it, right? To be as convincing as possible, because they're afraid that if they show any doubt, if they show any hesitancy in any way, that they're not going to get the treatment that they require and desire. And so that, I think, is a big part of this, where, we don't like to sit with that doubt, where the person who's prescribing or the person who's doing the surgery or the person who's, referring that person to another professional gets hesitant themselves. What if this is wrong? What if they are just confused? What if? And so that puts an excess amount of pressure on the person who's undergoing this process.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And like Jesse said, we welcome doubt in all sorts of other spheres, but there are entire sites, websites dedicated to how to talk to your psychologist so that you can get your letter. Well, I figure when people are that desperate that they're going to create a narrative to convince us, then it's something that's really, really important to them. But this is our fail. This is the fail. This is our fail as a profession and other professions involved in trans health, is that we have expected that. In the 1950s and 60s, I'll take a trans woman. So somebody assigned male at birth who's transitioning had to, if they were married, they were forced to divorce. No same-sex marriage at the time. They had to declare a heterosexual orientation. So all of a sudden they had to be interested in men. They had to want to be to represent femininity in a very stereotypical way. We think about Christine Jorgensen and others of that era, the pioneers, if you will, who were more feminine, the most feminine. And you had to go through years and years of living living without hormones or paper chains, it changes. So your name isn't changed, your gender marker isn't changed, you have no hormones, you have nothing. You had to immediately from day one transition socially. People lost their jobs, they lost families, they lost everything. So we have a rather awful history as a profession and psychiatry as well, et cetera, in terms of what we've done to force people to accommodate us and prove to us. So this is what we're trying to undo. And this is where I would say at the Institute, this is really what we're dedicated to doing, is undoing that and creating environments that will allow people to really feel welcome and feel supported and have the information. So part of it is we talk about informed consent as an approach, and I'm very much dedicated to informed consent. This is my philosophy and my paradigm. Informed consent will mean that the clinician is informed, right? So the clinician has to stay abreast of the field, and it's a field that very fast moving. So when we meet somebody, when I meet with an adolescent who's wanting blockers, if they're young, and if they're older, they're wanting the hormone treatments, we need to be able to talk to them. Okay, so these are the things that I'm getting from, you know, my assessment, a couple sessions of talking about your life. So this looks like socially, these might be some of the challenges, or socially you don't have any full support from your friends, your family, your boyfriend, etc. Great. So these are the other things that we might want to consider, some of the health things that you're dealing with. Let's talk about, you know, how do you see things in your future? What do you see in the short term, medium term, long term? Have you thought about this, 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 this? I want to have that list. I want to be able to say, have you considered this? Not because I'm challenging them, but because I just want to know that they've thought about it. That's informed consent. It's not just, okay, this is going to be the impact of hormones on your body. I want to talk about the psychosocial impacts. I want to talk about, you know, all sorts of things that I know about, that Jesse knows about, because we keep abreast of the literature, because we know what the challenges are in trans health. So we were able to bring that to the youth. Now, I'll tell you, the youth have access to a lot of the same sources we have. And even if it's not the actual journal articles that are behind, you know, paywalls, they have access to a lot of the information anyway. And they come to us already very informed.
Being informed is the key to all of this, to combating disinformation and misinformation, to receiving the healthcare you need, and to create public policy that does the least harm and the most benefit to the gender diverse community. To that end, I've included a few resources in the show notes today, including the 8th version of the standards of care that both Jesse and Francoise referenced, and Francoise's detransitioning workshop with the Institute for Trans Health. Thanks to both Jesse and Francoise for once again joining me to discuss these important topics and for their efforts to keep everyone as informed as possible on these issues. Thanks to you at home for listening, streaming, or downloading today's episode. Mindful is written, hosted, and published by me, Eric Bowman. Jamie Montgomery is our editor and producer, and our theme music is Avenues by David Taylor.